This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, we hear about catastrophic level fire conditions and drought in Australia as climate change bites in down under. Fire emergency expert Greg Mullins from the Climate Council joins us. We follow up with new science suggesting more than half our warming emissions are hidden by pollution in a process newly discovered. A cleanup to save your health could quicken Arctic ice changes and add heating around the world. We have guest Ran Feng. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We have a lot to do. Let's get going. Massive wildfires have appeared on every continent except Antarctica. Now it is hitting Australia, even at the end of winter there, with temperatures about 10 degrees C, over 20 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Over 130 bushfires were crackling over Australia in early September. A veteran Australian fire expert warns climate change makes the risk much worse, and it may break down the country's fire defense system eventually. And now, strangely, a change high above Antarctica makes this year's fire season even more ominous. We have reached Greg Mullins, former Commissioner of Fire and Rescue for New South Wales, for 13 years until his retirement in 2017. Greg has represented Australia for groups of Asian fire chiefs and the United Nations. He currently sits on the Climate Council, the publicly funded climate watchdog. From Sydney, Greg Mullins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you. So, Greg, you've been directing bushfires for a long time. What is different in the last couple of years?
Well, look, I've been fighting fires since 1972, and my father before me was a volunteer wildland firefighter from 1955. And we watched as the climate in Australia changed, and particularly in the mid-1990s. Now, after California had its 1993 firestorm, we had our 1994 firestorm in January that year. About 800 fires in the state of New South Wales alone, millions of acres burnt, hundreds of homes lost. Now, that came out of the blue. You can normally see the indicators of a bad season coming along, and I remember my father just shaking his head and saying, I just didn't see this coming. And look, before that, scientists were starting to sound the alarm about climate change. I had a deep interest in ecology and the environment and fire, of course, and I'd been talking to a lot of scientists, and they started to explain how just a tiny little increase in temperature changes everything, and we're bearing the brunt of it here now.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, we used to look forward to our summers, Greg, and now it's become a season that comes with a lot of worry and some fear. I've got a little emergency get-out-of-town-quick pack still sitting behind me. The season isn't quite over. Are Australians worried about the annual round of smoke and flames?
Look, Alex, we are, and the reason, it's always been a part of the landscape. It's one of the driest continents in the world here. The outback, the centre of Australia, is very arid. But around the coastal fringe, the forests and then the grasslands, very fire-prone. Now, in my state, I live in Sydney, the state of New South Wales on the east coast. Our bushfire season officially runs from 1st of October to 31st of March. Now, that was based on over a century of observations by meteorologists. We now start our season in the first week of August, 2 months earlier. Every year we're getting major fires. And as you said in the introduction, we have over 500,000 acres on fire in the north of our state right now. There's five major blazes that have been burning for weeks in remote areas, but about 30 homes have been lost already. In our state, 17 just north of the border. This is unheard of, or it had been unheard of for decades, but it is our new normal. So people are very worried. Fires are penetrating into areas where they've never been before, and I mean wet temperate rainforest, subtropical and tropical rainforest. Fires are burning very intensely through those areas because it's so dry. We're getting less rainfall, higher temperatures, stronger winds. And with the drier fuels, very, very intense fires that we're just not getting a grip on.
I was shocked when a couple of years ago there were wildfires in northern Tasmania where you expect it to be a rainforest. They said some of those trees hadn't burned in 1,000 or more years, and yet it appeared even there.
Look, this is just shocking. So Tasmania, big island to the, it's a southern state, but it's an island state to the south of Australia. Their major fire seasons used to be about 30 years apart, and it was quite rare. It wasn't seen as a really bushfire-prone state, but when they did get fires, they were big ones. But they were normally on the east coast in dry sclerophyll forest. So a lot of Tasmania is highlands and wilderness, and it's wet, temperate rainforest, old Gondwana forest that's been there for millions and millions of years, hosted dinosaurs. That's how old it is. It's drying out. The reduction in rainfall over the last 20, 30 years is immense, and it's now burning freely. And scientists have looked at the trees, the rings on the trees, the carbon record in the soil. They've never had intense fires like we've had in 2006, 2013, 2016, 2018, 2019. So you can see it's 30 years apart. It's just about every year now we have major fires in Tasmania. So Huon pine trees, which can live for 3,000 years, the second oldest living things on the planet, they're burning and they won't come back. They're not adapted to fire, and scientists are saying, look, it's unlikely they'll grow back.
And Greg, you've warned that if the fire season keeps extending like this, Australia's method of sharing firefighters and equipment could break down. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes, well, look, this is what's got every fire chief in Australia worried, and we're a bit different to the US and Canada. We don't have local municipal fire departments. They're statewide, so my fire department, Fire and Rescue New South Wales, 340 fire stations, about 7,000 firefighters, 6,000 volunteers, big organisations. So there's not as many fire chiefs. We get together regularly. What the paradigm of firefighting in Australia has been for decades is a progressive onset of fire seasons from north to south. The state of Queensland would have a fire season starting in maybe late July, but not very severe. They very rarely lost homes there. They were fairly mild fires compared to the southern states. We'd move into my state, New South Wales, around September, October. By then, Queensland could release their firefighters to come south to help us, and the southern states could help us. Our season would moderate a bit early in the next year, and we would go south and help the other states. What we're having now is simultaneous severe fire seasons, and it's stopping us sending people across borders. The other thing that we're experiencing, we lease all of our large firefighting aircraft, C-130 Hercules, 737, 15,000-litre water bombers, Ericsson Sky air cranes. They come from North America. Now, the extending fire season in California is a problem for us because that equipment's not available like it used to be. We had fires last year in August that destroyed homes, and again this year. We didn't have the large aircraft. So in New South Wales, our government just bought a single 737, but even when all the leased aircraft arrive, there'll only be seven large aircraft in the whole of Australia with about four or five air cranes. And then a whole lot of medium and small water bombers, fixed wing and rotary wing. And we're finding it's just not enough. So it's very difficult. It's a vast country with a relatively small population, very long distances. If we can't share firefighters, there's no one else nearby who can help us.
Meanwhile, some dams in New South Wales have almost run dry this year. Winter rainfall was dismally low. Towns may run out of water. Tell us about the great drought that's afflicting Australia this year and the relationship of that to fires.
Look, this is very, very worrying. So Sydney, which is has a population of 4.5 million, our major water supply dam is around 48% full now. We missed out on our winter rains. We've had some recent short, sharp rain events, which is how it happens now. They're not soaking long-term rains. We just have downpours, which basically runs off and goes into the ocean. We're not getting that rain over the catchments, but there's a lot of large towns and cities in New South Wales with populations of 30,000 up to 50,000. They're simply running out of water. Rivers have stopped flowing. Now, people talked about the Millennium Drought, 2001, 2002, where we had massive wildfires. This is officially worse than that. It's in some areas, it's the worst drought on record. Our major river system, the Murray-Darling system that runs through a number of states, has basically stopped flowing a lot of areas, massive fish kills, huge environmental damage. But they're bringing water by trucks and trains into some towns just so people have something to drink, digging bores. And then for firefighters, if we get a structure fire in a small town that doesn't have water, we don't use drinking water to put it out unless there's an exposure, another building around that might catch fire. The firefighters sit and let burn and just protect what's around it. So that's how serious it is. And with wildfires, massive areas of wildland, it's just very, very difficult to fight the fires without water. So a lot of backfiring, backburning, a lot of dry firefighting with hand tools. But because the forests are so dry, a single spark and all the work you've done can be lost in minutes. So it's extremely difficult.
But a couple of experts here on Radio EcoShock, I recall, told us that simply having hot and dry conditions isn't enough to guarantee a bad fire season. You need an ignition source, and usually around here that's lightning. But it can be humans setting fire to clear fields or forests, and then there's arson. Is there a serious intentional fire setting problem in Australia?
Look, when I was commissioner or fire chief for the state, people would often ask me, what are the main causes of fire? And I'd say, well, there's three of them. It's men, women and children. And that is, that is the case. People have accidents. They light fires deliberately for farmers, for example, burning off. At times of the year that for generations they could do that safely, now they can't and the fires are getting away. So a lot of the fires in the north of the state now are escaped burn-offs from farming activities. There is arson that, I'd like to think that's reducing. Our police authorities have done a lot of good work there. We've done a lot of public education. But we are seeing more lightning strikes. Now, you spoke about Tasmania. 2016, there were literally hundreds of lightning strikes over weeks, burnt out hundreds of thousands of acres of World Heritage rainforest. And this is becoming, with a warming environment, I'm not a meteorologist, but there have been studies here saying the warmer atmosphere, more unstable atmosphere is leading to more dry storms with no rain. And with drier fuels, fires are more likely to start when those lightning strikes hit a tree or hit a rock that has vegetation on it. So we're getting more and more remote fires starting. Just last week, I think it was last week or the week before, up where we have these massive fires burning, a line of storms went through, seven new fires in 20 minutes and no rain. So this is now a common thing. Where I live in Sydney, almost 50 years, lightning fires almost unheard of. We have them regularly now.
We have heard that from other scientists, that we can expect more lightning in a hotter world.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the veteran fire and emergency expert from Australia, Greg Mullins. We are watching over an early start to fire season there as climate change continues. At the end of August, the atmosphere high above the South Pole heated up. Greg, can you explain to our listeners what is sudden stratospheric warming?
Yes, well, Alex, this is something new to me, so I'm not entirely across it, but there's three major drivers in Australia of rainfall, heat, and ultimately fire danger. So the first one is the El Nino effect, La Nina and El Nino. So if we have an El Nino, it's tropical waters in the Pacific. If the trade winds run from east to west, and that brings moisture over Australia, if you get a change in ocean temperatures, it does the opposite. It can turn westerly and it stops a lot of the rainfall coming down to Australia. We have the Indian Ocean Dipole, which again is about the warming of the ocean to the northwest of Australia. If it's cooler, there's less moisture, comes across less cloud, less rainfall. So now we don't have an El Nino, and I'll get back to the Southern Annular Mode in a second. I know that's what you're interested in. Normally, when we have a drought like we're in now, we have an El Nino. So it's unusual that we don't, and we're getting fire seasons that are very destructive that in the past only happened during El Nino years, but now they're just sort of normal. The Indian Ocean Dipole is in positive mode. That's stopping a lot of rain reaching the east coast of Australia. So then we have the Southern Annular Mode. Now, that's all about the westerly wind flow around Antarctica. Now, normally it's pretty tight, stays to the south of Australia. Sometimes it's let off the leash and the winds come north and it actually brings more moisture. But what's been happening more and more is that those winds are contracting closer to Antarctica and it stops that moisture coming across the continent, particularly the southeast, where we've had 15 to 20% reduction in rainfall over decades, and this year up to 50% reduction in a lot of areas. So that's the Southern Annular Mode, and the stratospheric warming over Antarctica, which, you know, I do admit I don't fully understand. I'm not a meteorologist. But apparently that could cause us to have drier, but more windy conditions in southern Australia, which is our most hazardous place for bushfires. So we're bracing ourselves. We're already in drought. We've had record high temperatures. We had the highest fire danger index has ever recorded in September in New South Wales and Queensland, two adjoining states, on the 6th of September. So the first week of September, not the last week of September, we had what we call catastrophic fire conditions. In the US, they call it red flag conditions, but way off the scale. And that's when our massive fires really took off. So it's months and months ahead. So all these ingredients are just, they're pointing to a horror scenario. Everybody's really worried about this summer because we're not in summer yet. We're just into spring, beginning spring, and we've got massive fire problems already.
I'm also trying to understand this sudden stratospheric warming thing. It appears that the polar vortex reverses, and it happens fairly often in the northern hemisphere, I understand, and we just had one that dragged a heat wave west from Europe over Greenland, sort of against the normal jet stream. But the only other sudden warming that I could find happened at the South Pole appears to be in 2002, and now we're seeing one again. And I wonder if this large-scale disturbance will happen more often and affect Australia more often as well.
Well, look, this is again, I'm not really au fait with this, but with this is the problem. We're having more and more heat waves. 2002, when the climatologists told us that was the last time it happened here, that made all of the fire chiefs sit back in horror because that was one of our really bad fire years. So we lost, there were lots of homes lost that year, massive fires across Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, South Australia, Western Australia. So there were massive fires in 2002 basically across the whole continent. And if we're looking at that, after we've been in severe drought since 2017, our water supplies are dwindling and non-existent in many areas. We're really worried, really, really worried.
I hear what you're saying, and it sounds pretty scary to me. I would like to get to, you're with the Climate Council in Australia, and I didn't know a lot about it, but could you tell our listeners what it is and the interesting way that council got going?
Yes, so it was an interesting thing. So around a bit over 5 years ago, an incoming Conservative government decided that the Climate Commission, with the Chief Climate Commissioner, Dr. Tim Flannery, who was a former Australian of the Year, a scientist who rang the alarm bells on climate change years ago, has written a lot of books. He was the Chief Climate Commissioner, and a number of other people were climate commissioners. They'd come up with a carbon price, emissions were going down. So the incoming Prime Minister, one of his first acts within a couple of weeks was to abolish the council. I won't say he had a famous statement or an infamous statement about what he thought of climate change. I won't repeat it because he used a word starting with C, ending with P. said it was rubbish. He didn't believe in it. So within weeks, the community had rallied and crowdfunded the Climate Council to re-emerge. And so it's community-funded, and it's about keeping government honest. So it's a lot of experts in various areas, climate scientists, of course, people like me, I'm a fire expert, natural disasters. So we write a lot of papers. We interpret the scientific papers and make it digestible. So and look, if people, people can Google it, climatecouncil.org.au. There's a lot of papers on different things there, but we try to keep the government honest, and we're not doing very well with that. We've just heard our Prime Minister telling the world that he doesn't need to take much action on climate change, but he'll clean the oceans up of plastic and that'll fix everything. So that's what we're up against here. So Climate Council is working with other bodies to try and get real action on climate change, which is the base cause of what we're facing.
Is the current government listening when it comes to increasing fire danger as this warming continues?
No. They're in denial. So they're ideologically driven. It's all about business and profit. So our government is telling the world that they're doing their bit with the Paris Accord. Our emissions in Australia have gone up each year for the last 5 years of this government, not down. So the way they're going to meet the Paris targets is to use leftover credits from the Kyoto Agreement, because we overachieved on our extremely low targets, I think second lowest emissions targets in the Kyoto Agreement. So it's dodgy accounting, and it's an embarrassment to most Australians who know what's going on. So Australia's not doing its bit on the world stage to help reduce emissions. And the job of the Climate Council is to try and raise awareness of this. And we had massive rallies in all of the major cities last week, school children, but people went on strike from their jobs. Some companies shut down for the day to go and show their support. So there's a massive awareness, over 80% in Australia, of the climate problem and the need for action, but our government remains in denial.
That sounds very familiar. Here in Canada, we're in a similar situation. Perhaps the talk is better in Canada, but the actual action of expanding the tar sands pipelines puts us right in with Australia in expanding coal for export. We're in the same basket. My wonder is whether the bush that is burning in Australia, it's used to fire. There's been a long history of fire there, in some parts of Australia at least. But maybe it'll fail to recover with climate change, and maybe that desert that fills the interior of your continent will expand. Your thoughts?
That's an interesting thought, Alex, because each area has a fire regime, and the fire regime, ecologists say it's based on history going back tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. So species of plant evolve that can withstand the frequency and intensity of fire that's common over that huge time frame. Now, over a short time frame of some decades, the fires are becoming more intense and more frequent. So we're seeing, where I live near the coast in Sydney. I'm looking out my window at the ocean at the moment. Beautiful, but we have coastal heathland, native heathland, that burns very intensely. And if it doesn't burn within about 20 years, it can start to break down because it needs fire to germinate new seeds. But if you burn it more than once every 5 years, after about the third fire, there's no seed stock left in the soil, and that it can be eradicated forever from certain areas. And we're starting to see that. We're starting to see certain species removed from areas because of the frequent burning. And what tend to come in are weeds and grasses that regenerate every year and will burn every year. So it actually increases our fire problem, where fuel reduction burning or wildfires would remove the problem for 3 to 5 years as it regrew. Over time, if you get these fireweeds come in and ferns and things, you've changed the whole biota and you lose animal species as well.
I had a plan for this show for September and unexpectedly ended up having to cover fires in the Amazon, in Alaska and Siberia. We're talking in Angola, Indonesia, terrible smoke problems there and fires. And so I'm seeing that fires have become an international emergency. Greg Mullins, what are you hearing from other fire and emergency experts around the world?
Look, there's concern everywhere. And I've been, you know, believe it or not, I've been over to the United Kingdom twice during my career to help them gear up to fight bushfires. And in England, really? It just never happened. And fundamental things like their structural firefighting uniforms were too hot because the temperatures were going up. Their hoses were too large and going into areas where there was no reticulated water, so they had to have smaller diameter hoses and they had to start to use aircraft. Command and control of large events, you know, talking to other fire chiefs about how they do that. But look, I'll point to California as I worry about us facing the same as California did last year and the year before. I've fought fires in California back in 1995. I've got friends in the fire service there. I speak to Ken Pimlott, who recently retired as Cal Fire chief. And I've seen what bark beetles have done to the forests in California, how a lot of dead trees has increased the fuel loads, the longer seasons, and look at the number of homes that were lost last year in Paradise and other townships, and the massive fires. I just keep breaking records of the largest fire, Mendocino Fire, the Camp Fire. You know, thousands and thousands of homes. And if this isn't ringing alarm bells around the world for people, and having fires in places like Greenland and Sweden and Canary Islands, and then massive losses of lives in fire-prone areas that are getting worse, like Greece, Portugal, Spain, that, you know, nearly 100 dead in California last year, 173 dead in Australia in 2009, over one afternoon, thousands of homes lost. It's just supercharged. And you can no longer sit back and say, nothing to see here, move on everybody, there's no such thing as climate change. So world leaders, like in Australia, like in the USA, I have to say, I think it's really up to people to take local action, like California is doing, like my state is doing in Australia, bypass the national governments who are in denial. And we have to take action to save our planet.
Good message, Greg. Thank you. We've been speaking with fire and rescue expert Greg Mullins. He is a world-recognized expert on fires, currently with the Climate Council of Australia. Thank you so much for bringing us up to date.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Alex. Thanks for getting this message out.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Last week, I asked French scientist Olivier Boucher about the climate impacts of aerosols, the smog particles we launch into the atmosphere when we burn fossil fuels. He said that is hard to model. But new science finds another way than modeling by comparing the atmosphere now to a period around 3 million years ago. The continents were about the same then, and so were the CO2 levels, but the world was quite different. The results are astounding. This is hard science. Our guest speaks Chinese and English. If you listen, I promise climate news you have not heard before, and another kick to get us all going into rapid climate action. Buckle up.
Radio EcoShock.
Ran Feng is an assistant professor with the University of Connecticut. Her new paper studies a period about 3 million years ago when a climate shift created the savannas where our first ancestors evolved. That climate past may be our future. Ran Feng, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for inviting me. It's my pleasure being here.
I think we need to begin with some basics. Is it accurate to say that aerosol pollution is not caused by climate change and it exists as a separate ecological problem?
Yes, but incompletely. While the part of yes, meaning that the pollutant we created, emitted, and then gets transported in the troposphere since the Industrial Revolution, indeed is created by human and has been created by human and continued on. Well, if we think about forest fire, then the answer becomes a little bit different. If we're thinking about increasing forest fire activity, which is still active research on whether it's directly linked to climate change or it may also have some part with forest management, then the pollution, you could say, if we prove the link that the part of forest activity is induced by climate change, then we would also say that climate change may also play a role in increasing the amount of pollutants we have in the troposphere.
Yes, they're interlinked, but I think people get them a little confused. They think, oh, well, climate change has created smog, but not really, no. I mean, it is the oil and the coal and the gas that we burn that puts sulfates into the air that makes smog, but they're sort of different problems.
Yeah, it's different problem. While directly, I don't think it's caused by climate change, but indirectly, in terms of fire activity, then climate change could play a role. But that part, the second part, is still under active research.
I get you. Well, now, speaking about research, in 2016 and 2017, scientists at Stockholm University, led by Juan C. Acosta Navarro, suggested a significant fraction of the Arctic warming we've seen has developed since sulfur emissions peaked back in the 1980s. Could you explain the relationship between smog reduction in the Northern Hemisphere and a hotter Arctic?
Yeah, sure. So when you think about Arctic, the first thing pops in your mind is that during the summer, the days are very, very long. So you have a lot of sunlight, the solar energy, coming to the system, which makes the smog, and by changing the cloud properties, by making the cloud more reflective, very effective in terms of making this whole area more reflective of sunlight. So what they find is between 1980 and 2005, due to more strict environmental regulations, Europe, the sulfur emission from the Europe has gone down. Without those smog, without those particles that forms the cloud droplets and then enhance the overall reflectivity of clouds, you started to have a less generally reflective Earth, especially in the Arctic part, which allows more sunlight to come in, especially so during the summer, which have caused the sea ice, at least in their research, to melt back, which then expose the darker ocean surface and allows more sunlight to come in, then subsequently cause this enlarged warming. In their study, they get 0.5 degrees Arctic warming, only with about a little bit, 3.3 watts per meter square increase in the net radiation. The other component they find is when the smog is reduced, regionally in the Europe, it changes the heating contrast between the land and ocean in the way that it allows more atmospheric heat transport and allows more ocean heat transport during the summer to giving heat to the Arctic region that also contributed to the sea ice melt and the warming.
Well, this is very important because we, thinking about this red-hot Arctic that we just experienced this summer, people are talking about the increased carbon dioxide, and that's true. That is causing more global warming. They're talking about methane, and there is more methane coming out. But they don't usually talk about the reduction in sulfates, reduction in smog. And so here's a third factor that turns out to be quite important that the scientists are working on.
Yeah, so this is very, very new. You probably noticed those papers. They're all published within like the past 4 years. So I would say a lot of researchers, including myself, started to notice this very large effect of sulfate aerosols and as well as other aerosol species that can help form clouds, that can help increase the reflectivity of clouds on the climate system. Especially, including myself, what we find is Arctic seems to have this higher sensitivity to this forcing than a lot of other places around the world.
And it's not just the Arctic. I mean, Navarro and his team also showed a global mean temperature would go up if current promises to reduce air pollution are kept. And they say if you slash the air pollution, Earth's mean temperature could go up anywhere from a third of a degree to almost 1 degree C, they say. And that suggests Earth would already be much hotter without that smog shielding out some of the sun. Do you agree with that?
Yes, that's what's very new right now. There are two papers, one in Science and one in Nature, just published this year. I think one's in February, and the one just published a few days ago. They're all looking at how much this relative effect by altering the property of clouds from the anthropogenic pollutants would have on the overall radiation budget of the Earth. And I think a lot of scientists agree that overall, this part of the radiative effect of the aerosol is going to be a negative effect. So indeed, those pollutants, through altering the cloud reflection, have already cooled the Earth substantially, in addition to what we know, which is direct reflect and scattering of the sunlight by those little particles themselves. Well, it remains a little controversial on how much. It seems like on an intermediate scenario, the radiative cooling effect due to the effect on clouds could be around like -0.5, a little bit more than -0.5 watts per meter square, which is something around like 630 ppm CO2 equivalent. Well, a worst case scenario, it could be already masking something on the order of 60% of the global warming we would otherwise have experienced without pollutants that we put in the troposphere. Yeah, so short conclusion is, I think, yes, a lot of research have looked into this, and this is new because previously I think most people were thinking about the direct reflection and scattering of the sunlight by those tiny particles, and that effect is relatively small compared to the effect that the aerosols make the clouds more bright and last longer. The latter is a bigger effect, and we become more and more realized that it's very important, but at this stage, it's still very active research area.
Wow. So we could possibly, and this is just possibly, get double the warming if we clean up the pollution. Now, to get to the bottom of that, and we need more science, your latest papers and accepted for publication in Geophysical Research Letters investigates a time around 3 million years ago, and it is called, and this will be a new word for many of my listeners, the mid-Piacensian period. Why did you look at that time?
That's a great question. Yeah, so mid-Piacensian, it's a little hard to pronounce, and even my colleagues are not like super thrilled about the name of the time, but it's a very cool period. It is very cool for two main reasons. First, it is the last time we saw a CO2 level similar to present day. There's good evidence. There's many, many proxy meaning we use the geological record to estimate climate variables. So a lot of proxies agree that the CO2 level during this time is very similar to present day. The other reason is this period of time has a continental distribution, continental configuration, like the land, sea, the coastal line, the land, sea shape, and as well as the topography, like Himalayas, Andes, and all that. Very similar to present day. So by looking at that period, we can gain a future perspective of the current day Earth by looking at what the Earth was like during a period of time that are sort of equivalent to what we're heading to in the future.
And what was the air like in that mid-Piacensian period 3 million years ago? Was it polluted or clean or what?
Short answer is you would not have any of the pollutants, like teratons and teratons of sulfate, organic particulate matter, like nitrous oxide and all that stuff. You would not have any of that produced by human activity in the air. And also you would have a less dusty air in general, just because the climate is wetter and we have very limited glaciers only on the eastern side of Greenland and the eastern side of Antarctic. So that the overall wet climate and the much more reduced glacial erosion would be likely to give us a overall less dusty troposphere. On the other hand, my colleague who I worked with during my postdoc, University of Montana, they have records from Canadian Arctic. And in their records, they saw this interesting layers and layers of charcoal. Well, for present day, and especially for people who live in Canada, probably know this the best. If you go anywhere above the tree line of the boreal forest, above, like, let's say 65 degrees north, you would not find forest fire activity. There's no fire activity. Well, for Pleistocene, those charcoal layers suggesting there's pretty active fire activity, which to us would suggest a different state of biochemistry, biogeochemical feedback being active at that time, meaning there's probably a lot more widespread forest fire in the northern highland shield, which will produce smog, one thing, but other precursors for greenhouse gases, for example, tropospherical ozone could be produced through photochemistry, while nitrous oxide could be produced from precursors from the burning product. So in that sense, depending on where you go, you might still be running into pollution at this time.
Even 3 million years ago.
Yeah, but it's mainly from forest fire, so it's not human-induced.
Right.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with Ran Feng from the University of Connecticut. A few years ago, it was fringe science to suggest the Arctic would be ice-free anytime during this century. Now, all bets are off. We're not sure. What did you find out about an ice-free Arctic in that previous age when conditions were somewhat like our present?
So it was very interesting that, in the sense that in paleoclimate community, I think it has been thought for quite a while that among the geologists who study this time period, that this time period should at least be seasonally sea ice free, meaning during the summer season, probably not going to have extensive Arctic sea ice. Well, there's earlier evidence are all more or less qualitative. So they look at the geomorphology in the high Arctic region, especially a lot of work are done in Canadian Arctic, and they notice active river channels, meaning that this place cannot be just be frozen all year round, cannot have a glacier sitting on top. While they also find high Arctic camel, which is unlikely to exist if the place is really, really cold. While more recently, there are more quantitative geochemistry evidence that people were able to look at the atom, the carbon atom that are produced by ice diatom, that the diatom living underneath the ice. And by marrying this long-chain carbon item compound, they can look at the abundance of this CI item changed through time. And it's quantitatively showing that Arctic should be CI seasonally, summer, specifically CI free, for the Mipria Chimsian time. They're consistent with qualitative evidence. So I think the evidence is pretty good for this time period. But it has been really difficult for models to reproduce with present-day CO2 level, this summer sea ice-free Arctic Ocean, until pretty recently when our model started to be able to simulating this process of forming clouds from the small aerosol particles. This allow us to produce different cloud forming state in the troposphere with or without the pollutant. So in our research, the first question we're interested in looking at is, well, we know that for the Mid-Pro Chanzen time, we don't have industrial pollutants. So, but for present day climate, we do. And for previous model simulations, the model doesn't have the capability of featuring this cloud interaction with aerosols. So we set up our experiment. We compared two experiments, one with the industrial pollutants and the other one that we removed all the industrial pollutants. And the radiative forcing is enough, despite being small, is enough to push the Arctic into a summer sea ice free state. So in our simulations, what we started to learn is that for the Mid-Pro Chanzen time, whether or not a simulation entering a summer sea ice free state could be induced by the removal of anthropogenic pollutants, which would suggest that when we're thinking about future climate, we're already at 400 ppm CO2. By removing the anthropogenic pollutant, we're actually putting a greater risk to the Arctic community in terms of entering a different Arctic sea ice state, summer sea ice free.
Okay, so we know that cutting air pollution will reveal the true level of heating caused by our emissions, but could cleaner air boost even further warming if the sea ice is gone for a month or two during summer and fall? Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so what in our paper we find is that you guys probably have heard the ice albedo feedback. During the summertime, or just in general for the Arctic region, if you have an increase in incoming solar radiation, you would melt back the sea ice. While sea ice reflects solar radiation, the fact that sea ice melted back is going to allow the surface to absorb more solar radiation. So the surface gets even warmer, which melts back sea ice even more. So this process goes on and on. That's a positive feedback. So what we find in our paper is that when you look at the amount of net solar radiation at the top of the atmosphere, for winter season and for late fall season, in two cases, one with the pollutant, the other one without the pollutant, it's quite similar. So you only see when the case without pollutant start to absorb more solar radiation at the beginning of the summer. And we're able to see that in our model, that this little boost of surface absorption by a little less cloud reflection can actually trigger this so-called positive ice albedo feedback or positive runaway ice albedo feedback, which actually allows the Arctic Ocean to reach a sea ice free state by itself through the positive feedback persisted through the season.
We talk a lot about air pollution and the warming Arctic. Is there a similar activity happening at the other pole in the Antarctic?
Right. So in the Antarctic is a little bit shielded from the rest of the world. Obviously, it's sitting at the South Pole and it's not connected to any continent. So it's hard for the pollutants to travel to and then deposit on Antarctic. However, the bigger problem for Antarctic is actually the emission of CFCs. which subsequently destroy ozone. And through the Montreal Act agreement, a lot of countries have eliminated their emission of CFCs, but more recently, a group of research led by the Bristol Group, University of Bristol Group, they discovered that there's still CFC emissions coming out of China from the observation station they have in Hawaii. So that has been a pretty big problem for our agreement to protect the ozone. So Antarctic ozone hole is shrinking, but it should be shrinking at a faster rate as it is compared to what it is now. And so unfortunately, it seems like CFC is still coming out of China. I think that's a bigger concern for now.
And in the middle of the world, we have the tropics, and there you also investigated that ancient warming that was so similar to our present and maybe our future. As published in Geophysical Research Letters in August 2019, what can the mid-Piacenzian warming tell us about ocean currents and weather in the tropics?
The interesting thing about the tropics is that we don't know how the tropical circulation could change in response to the increase in greenhouse gases. When we're looking into future predictions, there are theories about maybe it will strengthen. There are theories about maybe it will weaken in terms of the Walker circulation. So the Walker circulation is this circulation cell with rising air around the Western Pacific warm pool. There's a puddle of really warm water and the rising air from that region and penetrates into the troposphere. And this rising air turns east and descends in the eastern side of the tropical Pacific and comes back to the western tropical Pacific, and then this complete, this horizontal, this zonal cell. So it's very hard to actually say whether this zonal cell is going to weaken or is going to strengthen. There are theories to support both sides. Well, we're able to show that by combining our climate simulations and the proxy data, the geochemical data results, that from the ancient observations, we can say that our data and model support that the circulation cell is probably going to weaken. Well, this is from our opinion. You probably can interview somebody with different opinion, to be honest. Well, this has implications on the droughts, especially for the U.S. Southwest, because we know that U.S. Southwest is drought-prone when looking to the future. Just by looking from the perspective of greater evaporation because of the hotter land surface. But also there is an element that if the Walker circulation is strengthening, that would correspond to the cooling sea surface, cooler sea surface temperature in the eastern tropical Pacific, which actually would create a more drought-promoting or precipitation-suppressing atmospheric circulation condition for the U.S. Southwest region. So that's something that we can potentially gain insights by looking into the past climate that we have records, or you can think of that we have observation on looking at those controversial, I mean, still controversial research topic at the present.
So the science isn't settled yet, but is it possible that cutting air pollution could change storms or even the Asian monsoons that are vital for feeding billions of people in Asia?
So, again, this is still also a pretty active research area. But I think even in the late 90s, people already started talking about air pollution could have an effect on the general monsoon strength, potentially, or the variability of the monsoon rainfall. And the general idea is smog by itself, like from sulfate and all that, they could have a cooling effect over a region, while a large amount of our energy of the monsoon circulation is actually set up by the land and ocean thermal contrast. So the idea is that during summer, the air above the land area then to be heated up first, and that would develop the low-pressure system that allows the monsoon flow to transport, or that would initialize the monsoon flow to carry moisture from the ocean and transport it on land. Well, if you put a large perturbation on this land-sea thermal contrast, that will, of course, have effects on the circulation and hence on the monsoon precipitation.
Ren Feng, as a young scientist, you already have a strong track record of publication. What direction are you heading in next?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So we just get funded from NSF. Like this tropical study, we're very interested in looking at the general tropical state, temperature state, and circulation state. While the other aspect is we're also interested in what precipitation looked like back in mid-Pleistocene time, which may serve an analog of our long-term changes into the future. And we actually just got funded to look at the mid-Pleistocene precipitation from the Gulf of California. So we're using this type of geochemical proxy called lift wax, which is deposited into the ocean and transported by rivers on land across a large area. So this integrated proxy can give us information on the general precipitation information of the U.S. Southwest. So we're interested in looking at whether this region have more precipitation back in the mid-Pleistocene time or whether this region has been drier. Because when we look at future predictions, precipitation is one of the things that are really hard to predict. And by looking at past changes, focusing on this region, we can hopefully learn about the model scale and learn about what a warm world, what we would expect in a warm world in terms of precipitation changes. So this is one specific question. While my general interest lies in both in terms of understanding the Earth's history, how climate interacted with tectonics, how the mountain building have affected climate, and how does climate affect the ecosystem. While the other part of my research is to focus on understanding the model scale and to use some of the knowledge from past climate to help provide some information about our future climate, like those two papers that I did with a bunch of co-authors.
We've been speaking with the author of brand new research titled Contributions of Aerosol Cloud Interactions to Mid-Pleistocene Seasonally Sea Ice-Free Arctic. And Ren Feng works with the University of Connecticut, and you can find links and more information in my weekly blog published at ecoshock.org. Ren, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex. It's my pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
So the Swedish team, led by Navarro, found that Europe's reduction of air pollution may have warmed the Arctic by half a degree C. That is because, as Ren Feng's research shows, we are looking at pollution the wrong way. It is true smog, especially sulfates from burning coal, oil, and gas, does bounce some solar radiation back into space. That cools the planet, perhaps half a degree, although the exact amount is uncertain. But the real cooling arrives because aerosol particles trigger more clouds that cool the Earth even more. The masking effect of global dimming is much greater than we thought. It is hiding perhaps half of the true warming that will be revealed as various countries clean up the air. They're trying to save millions of people from premature deaths. That is the awful position we are in. I hope some people will download Ren Feng's interview and listen to it again from my website at ecoshock.org. We need climate watchers to take this apart and communicate key points to a wider public. Go on, put it in social media, blog about it, talk about it. Help get new climate science out there. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening this week and caring about our world. We go out with a small selection from Swedish climate striker Greta Thunberg addressing the United Nations special meeting on climate change in New York.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet, I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you!